And for this evening's talk, I'm going to be addressing a subject which is central to Buddhist teachings, but it's difficult to understand. It's the understanding that of craving or desire, and how that actually fits into our modern day lifestyles. Especially for those of you who know traditional Buddhism, you know, in all of the schools of Buddhism, we have something called the Four Noble Truths, and the Second Noble Truth states quite bluntly that craving is the source of suffering. And so that as Buddhists we're supposed to somehow let go of craving and have no desires or few desires. But then how do we actually practice that in our daily lives? Because as much as we do desire, as much as we want, does that mean that we should all just become monks and nuns, or just give up our jobs and just live on the street and not look after our kids and not have the latest clothes? What does it really mean? It's a difficulty for many Buddhism, for many Buddhists, try and to reconcile our lifestyles with the idea that suffering is caused by craving. So I'm going to investigate what that really means, especially in our lives today. And I thought we can actually start by just, you know, knowing that our present world is in great danger because of the untrammeled or unrestricted craving of our species, always wanting more and more. And obviously that cannot be sustained. A few years ago we were talking about ozone layers, now we're talking about global warming. Interesting to see what comes next. But it all seems to come by just, you know, using too many resources. And it's tough being a modern Western person to see how can we actually deal with this, because yeah, maybe once we've finished our house then we can actually start to worry about global warming, or once we've got what we need then we can actually try and help other people. And unfortunately that sometimes that's not really sufficient actually to save our future. And we see like so many wars and so many arguments, so many competition over limited things, that we wonder, you know, is this the world we really want to bequeath to our children, and is this the world we really want to live in ourselves? Now, as far as the 2500 years ago Buddhism was concerned, they're saying that, you know, the biggest problem here is like the craving. Sure that, yeah, we want to sort of try and do something with global warming, we want to have peace on earth, we want to have couples being able to live happily together, we want to have people sharing the resources of our planet, but something called craving gets in the way. And this is our problem. However, that craving doesn't mean no desires. This is going to be maybe the central point of this talk today. It's as if that desire is okay, but we're desiring the wrong things in life. You know, we're desiring the material things rather than the spiritual things. Measuring people by possessions rather than by qualities such as compassion and virtue and peace. And we're actually having goals in our life, you know, which allow us to pay off our mortgages, but we'll never have enough time for ourselves and our loved ones. So the heart of this talk today is, well, we have to have desires. That's part of being a human being. It's part of having a mind. And some of those desires are very worthwhile. But what type of desires do we have in our life? And being a monk, I'm in a privileged position simply because that, you know, you do have acquaintances across the spectrum. You know, from very poor people to very wealthy people, from presidents to prisoners, from multimillionaires to people on the dole. And when you actually meet all these types of people, you know, you can actually see that it's not really the economic circumstances which determines their happiness. This was one of the first insights I got when I was, you know, a relatively wealthy Westerner. And I say this even though I was a student with, you know, very little money, and holes in my jeans. I had holes in my jeans because I couldn't afford better ones, not because it was a fashion statement. I was ahead of my time, because these days people buy jeans straight from the shop with pre-made holes. But mine were real. But they're going to a place like northeast Thailand, in the villages, a long way away from anywhere. There were subsistence farmers who just had very spare cash and would live on a barter economy, just growing rice and whatever they could catch, especially fish in the rainy season, and building their houses of whatever can be found in the forest or in the fields. And you saw there that some of those people were just so poor compared to the poor student I thought I was. I was actually very wealthy compared to them. But one of the things which I did notice living in that village, many of those poor people were happier than the people I knew at sort of a great university like Cambridge. But I also saw some miserable people in that village. And when I saw those miserable people in that village, I wanted to find out why that some people were miserable and other people were happy, when they both had very few things. And I found out that basically it worked out like this. Every house had a water buffalo, which they used to plow the fields, and the dung from the water buffalo would be the fertilizer for their fields, and the buffalo would plow their fields and do all sorts of tasks like pulling the cart. It was a very important part of their house. But I noticed the farmers who had, say, one water buffalo and were happy with one water buffalo seemed to be the ones always smiling. But the farmer who had one water buffalo and wanted two, that was the farmer who was unhappy, who didn't seem to have so much time and so much joy in their lives. It seemed to me that happiness was not so much how much you have, but how much you want. And that started to make me think, you know, the basic question in life, how much do you really need to be happy in life? And does it really mean the more you have, the happier you are? And I think that's the great myth of our modern existence, thinking the more we have, the more pleasure and happiness and freedom and power we can exert. But every one of you, you know, is old enough to know by now that that promise of freedom and happiness when you gain wealth is a very false promise. Those people who experience, you know, the gain of wealth, people whose business goes well, people who win the lottery or inherit, come into a great deal of money, very often realize it spoils their lives. A classic story is a few years ago, one of the people who won a huge lottery in the United States, $100 million or more, his picture was in the newspaper being led to jail. He was a very happy man before he won the lottery. And then as soon as he won the lottery, things started to go wrong in his life. Sure, before he won that lottery, you know, he didn't have much money, but he had enough to sort of enjoy his life, you know, to be able to eat and have a modest little house and go out with his friends. But as soon as he became really, really wealthy, all of his friends he could not trust anymore, so all asking for loans or bits of money here and there. It was one of the problems with wealth, that even though it promises you so much, it tends to limit your enjoyment of the world rather than facilitate it. And I've seen this so many times that sometimes I wonder, what do you want wealth for? It's much better to not be wealthy and not be poor, but be someone in the middle. And that reminded me of one of the books I read as a student, which was a very famous book, Plato's Republic, where in the last chapter, this was, you know, Greek philosophy of 2,500 years ago, in the last chapter where they were describing reincarnation, and most of the Greeks believed in reincarnation at that time, it was just common knowledge. So, you know, reincarnation is not an Asian thing, it was right there in Europe, you know, 2,000 or so years ago. And in Plato's Republic, he was noticing that in this last chapter about reincarnation, that when people chose their future lives, this was, you know, his way of describing it, it's a wonderful metaphor, when you chose your wealthy lives, the stupid people were the ones who chose to be rich and powerful in their next life. Because the rich and powerful have far more suffering than the people who are just right in there in the middle. And so first of all, you know, that Buddhist teaching of the middle way just applies to your wealth as well. Please don't aspire to being too wealthy. because you'll find it gives you more problems in life. If you just have enough in the middle somewhere, medium income, that's good enough. And indeed, what Plato said 2,500 years ago in Greece was confirmed by a famous study which was done in the United States 12 months ago, where they were trying to find out what the maximum happiness was compared to people's annual income. And it was not that hard to gain the information, the data. They had a huge sample of people from different levels of income, and they could gauge their happiness by, you know, how strong their marriages were, whether they had many divorces, whether they were depressed, drug dependency, alcoholism, and all these very clear indicators that things were going wrong in your life or things were going well in your life. And I've done a huge sample. They actually found out that the optimum income, in other words, the income which was guaranteeing you the best happiness, was about $50,000 US per year. More than that, and your happiness level went down. Less than that, and you just couldn't afford the things which you wanted. So you weren't happy. So actually the best, as far as happiness was concerned, and this was proved, you can look at the research yourself, I have a large sample, and I think it's probably similar in Australia, similar demographic, about 50,000 US, or the equivalent over here, would that be about 55,000 Australian or something, was the optimum income. More than that, and you'd have more suffering. Less than that, you'd have more suffering. So that's actually the income to aim for. So if you're earning more than that, the Buddhist Society of WA can help you become happier by allowing you to give the difference to our retreat centre, to our nuns' monastery, or to this joint. Or even better, just to tell your boss, 55,000 is enough for me, I don't want the raise. Because I want to be happy. Now people laugh at that, but actually that's evidence-based. And that's Dharma-based as well, that's Buddhist-based. Because sometimes we think the more money, the more happiness. And the truth of the matter is opposite. So when you are having your desires and cravings, your aspirations in life, please keep that in mind. And number two, if we don't want the salary, what most people aspire to in this life, and you work your butts off for this, is actually to get the nice big house in a nice suburb. Now look at Noramara here. This was actually a bad suburb before we came in. And now we raise the house prices. So those of you who want to invest in property, and you've got a property in some suburb, build a monastery next door or a temple. And your house prices will go. No, that's not the point. The point is, what I've often seen is, you can see this huge houses which are built these days. And even a week ago, just I went to our local council's that Christmas lunch, and it was over in Jarrahdale, because, you know, we want to be friends with our local councillors and other sort of people in the Shire of Serpentine, Jarrahdale. I went now for, you know, for PR. And as we're going through Jarrahdale, which is, you know, a very pretty little town in the hills, there was a big development there, and these huge houses in the forest. But before I got to these huge mansions, I passed these small, the old wooden cottages which used to be in that logging town or timber town of Jarrahdale. I saw these huge places, and I think, my goodness, people must have to work so hard to pay for these big mansions. And I thought, what are they doing that for? Now, number one, if you have a very, very big house, people say, well, I need that for my family. Gee, that when I grew up, you know, we were living on top of one another. And I was in the same bedroom with my brother, you know, all the time. Sure, we used to fight, but we also learned how to love one another as well. You had to, because there was no escape in such a short, small house. one of the things which you learn living in such close quarters with other members of your family is how to get on together. And when you live in such a huge place when everyone has their own rooms, actually probably two or three rooms for every person in the family, it means you've got too many bolt holes, too many places you can go instead of fixing up the social problems which you have with your siblings or with your parents and children. There's many advantages to living in close quarters with one another. You tend to get on. And I think that is one of the social problems which comes with people living in such huge houses in our modern age. We don't know how to live with each other. And maybe that is the cause of so many divorces, of people changing partners. We haven't learned those skills of cooperation and give and take between one another. You have to learn that when you're living in such close quarters. I remember my father telling me, at least I had my own bed when I grew up. He shared his bed with about six or seven brothers and even sisters when he grew up. I said, how can you go to sleep that way, just in a small bed with, you know, four or five, six other brothers in the same bed? But he certainly knew how to sort of cooperate with in such a small bed. But they didn't have such a great time. They loved each other very, very much. So sometimes that we think that the wealth will give us such a huge property, but it comes at a great cost. And one of the biggest costs, you know, is how hard you have to work, how many hours you have to spend just paying for such a big place. You can only be in one room at a time. And sometimes that we, as an example, as a counterexample, we have our monasteries where we live. And I enjoy taking people to see where I live. Even years ago when I lived in a bigger place than I live now, there was a big room, maybe 3 meters by 2.4, with a little walking path in the front. And I still remember about 10 years ago taking a group of women who were visiting the monastery. It was a local women's group who wanted to do weird things on an afternoon and never been to the monastery, and that qualified as being weird. And when I took them to see my hut, my room, I always remember this one of the girls turning around to me and saying, wow, if only my house were this small, I'd get all my housework done in half an hour. And she looked at my simplicity with a lot of envy. Which is the other reason. Huge houses take a lot of maintenance and a lot of work. And you haven't got the time. Number one, you're working so hard to pay off the mortgage. And number two, you're having to work so hard to maintain the place and keep it clean. And you never manage to get all the things done. So isn't there something wrong about that? So it's great to be able to downsize. Any of you who come and visit Bodhinyana Monastery, and many of you have saw this, my cave where I live. And it is a small cave. It's not even about 2.5 meters, if it's that, circular, and about that high. It's only a little cave where I live. And that's so easy. When I wake up in the morning, it takes me about 30 seconds to make my bed. I sleep on the floor. It just takes about 5 minutes to sweep it out. It's just a simple place to stay, and it gives me so much time and so much freedom. This is an example that when we have big places, we think that this is going to create happiness and space. Sure, it's got physical space, but we have no time space left. And that is one of the great complaints of our modern age. We're material wealthy, but time poor. So, we have desires, we want comfort, we want well-being, we want sort of some happiness, but sometimes our cravings and desires are misplaced. They haven't got wisdom with it. And a lot of times it is because, you know, we are sheep. We just follow what other people do. One of the great things about religion, what they should be doing, especially, you know, paths like Buddhism, is making you question. Don't just follow what other people are doing, like lemmings just going over the cliff of environmental destruction. think for yourselves, question, don't follow the norm, but follow wisdom and common sense as what is said. If you follow what other people are always up to, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. If you just think, well, most people are doing it, it must be right. Always remember one of my favorite quotes from Voltaire. It was Voltaire who made a quote from mathematics. Because I was a mathematician as well. One of his famous quotes, which I thought was very funny, but also so true, the only way to understand the mathematical concept of infinity, to really get your head around what infinity means, is to contemplate the extent of human stupidity. Now you know what infinite means. So it's a waste of time following other people. We question and find out for ourselves. So it doesn't matter what other people are saying, and saying, oh, you should sort of, you know, upgrade, move to a bigger house. It's an investment for the future. Maybe your future, but not your children's future. And it's not a future for your peace and happiness and the time. How much do you really need? And it's the same when we want sort of fame or status. Even when I was a young monk, there was a fellow monk, his name was Gary. And I remember that as a young man, he grew up in Los Angeles. And no, he met that film star. Who was that who played Dirty Harry? What was his name? Oh, Clint Eastwood. Yeah, he met Clint Eastwood in his early days because they went to the same university together. He told all these stories about, you know, being with the rich and famous. But he remember once when that singer Bob Dylan was in Los Angeles, and he found out from his friends which hotel he was in, and managed to use some of his contacts to sneak in the back and spent sort of the whole evening and night with Bob Dylan. And sort of, you know, this is a famous man at that time, you know, was multi-famous. And Bob Dylan was saying, now he was said to Bob Dylan, oh, it must be great being famous. And just Bob Dylan swore and just said, no, it's whatever it is, I can't repeat it here, terrible being famous. It was such a pain to be well known. Now, I'm not as well known as Bob Dylan, but I think you know that sometimes I've gone to the toilet at Singapore Airport and not even been able to go to the loo because someone in the toilet of Changi Airport stopped me to ask me questions on meditation. And sometimes that happens here as well. At 7:25, I'm trying to get to the toilet before I do the talk here, and someone stops me. Oh, actually, I'm wrong. So one of the great things of being sort of not famous is you can go to the toilet whenever you want without people stopping. So, but do you want to be famous? Would it be lovely to be famous? Why do people go on these TV shows? Was it like Australian Idol or these other Big Brother shows? And they want to be famous. They must really sort of need to see a psychiatrist very quickly, because no one in their right mind would want to be famous. But a lot of times people desire that, they want that, they crave that. And really they're sort of putting all of their energies into the wrong place. There's a great story which, you know, sort of I adapted and wrote in a newsletter, a journal for one of the Buddhist centres in Sydney. And I told at a recent sort of concert in Singapore. It's a nice story about a monastery somewhere in the world. And in the middle of the night, so the abbot was woken up, he heard a noise in the main shrine room. So he got up and checked. Sure enough, there was a burglar in the temple. And as soon as the burglar saw the abbot, the burglar was trying to open the donation box. And he told the abbot just to get out of here. And the abbot took one look at the burglar. And instead of actually stopping the burglar, said, you're trying to open the donation box, here's the key. So the burglar took it and told him not to do anything. But the abbot took one look at the burglar, like many burglars, and this guy was so thin. So the abbot asked him, when was the last time you ate? The burglar said, shut up! When I give talks, I always like to sort of wake people up every now and again. Shut up, he said. But the Abba did shut up. He said, look, there's some leftover food from this morning's meal in the cupboard. Help yourself. And the man was hungry. So just looking at the abbot and brandishing a knife from the kitchen, he said, don't come near. He quickly sort of stuffed some food into his mouth. And the abbot told him, don't rush, there's plenty of time. And the burglar opened the donation box, emptied it, took some more food and ran away, saying, don't call the police. The abbot said, oh well, look, the donations are there. It's for charity, for compassion. You're a poor person. Just take what you want. I'll clear it with the committee tomorrow. And so the next day, when the committee heard about this, at least the guy was being kind, and they really liked the abbot for being kind. But usually what happens a few days later, that burglar was caught robbing another house somewhere. He was sentenced to jail. The abbot forgot all about that until a few years later, the burglar returned with another knife. He came and said, do you remember me? I robbed this temple 5 years ago. Now I've come to rob it again. But the burglar said this time, but last time I took the wrong thing. I took the money. Putting down his knife, he said, now I've come to take compassion and wisdom. Please show me how you were so kind to me, even though that I was about to kill you and rob your temple. And so the burglar, realizing that the first time he thought that money was happiness, over those 5 years realized kindness was more important than money. He said the first time he'd stolen the wrong thing. Now he came to take the right thing and asked the abbot to teach him compassion and kindness. And I like that story because sometimes when we want something, we're wanting the wrong thing. It's okay to want, but not the material things in life. The rich people in this world are not the people in the big houses. The rich people in this world are the people with the big hearts. Those people who are wealthy are not the people with the big bank balances. Those people who are wealthy are the people who've got time for each other. Isn't that so? It's obviously the quality of life, which is why the craving which we have in this world is actually wrongly directed. And that's why it leads to suffering. And usually as you go older and older and older in life, as what other people do, you start to question more and more. When you experience getting the big house or the wealth or the fame, so many people say, so what? Is this it? Is this what I work so hard for? And where's the payoff? Because such craving, we call it unfaithful craving. We call it unfaithful because it promises so much but fails to deliver. But the desire for the beautiful qualities of life, things like peace, time, contentment, kindness, compassion, generosity, those are the real things which it's wonderful to crave for, which is great to desire. You're actually desiring something which is truly worth something in life. Why? Because what does the wealth, the money, the house, the car, what does it really promise you? And it promises you freedom and happiness, respect, security. That's sometimes what people think about these days, that, well, if I get wealthy, then I can be secure and can be happy forever after. And I still remember a story which I read as a young man. Maybe I read all the right stories, which is why I became a monk. Instead of seeking fortune in the world, I sought fortune in my heart. And there was a man who was in the boom years of the United States in the roaring 20s, made enough money and managed to cash it in before the depression years. And being a multimillionaire, he decided, why should I just live in the United States? Are there any other places in the world where I can live which have got a better climate, safer, more happy existence? So he went to the local public library, got out books, And he used his intelligence to try and find the perfect place in the world where he could retire and enjoy his remaining years using his great wealth. He could go anywhere he wanted with so much money. And so he decided on a tropical island with perfect climate. It was called Guadalcanal. For those of you who are old enough, you know that Guadalcanal became famous because it was the site of two major battles in the Second World War. First, when it was taken over by the Japanese Imperial troops, and then it was actually taken over by the Americans afterwards. It was two huge battles. So there was a guy who made his pile and thought, I'm now going to retire to Guadalcanal, thinking it'd be peaceful forever after. And what happens? He gets involved in two major wars. He actually survived both battles, apparently, two major battles. He survived both and lived to tell the tale, but it wasn't a peaceful place. So I don't know where you want to retire, whether it's to Peppermint Grove or to Mindari Keys, I don't know what other place you think, but who knows what's going to happen there later on. That's the trouble, they might have a new airport in Peppermint Grove next 5 years, or wherever else you live. Now this is the great uncertainty of life, so you cannot trust such material investments. Sometimes you invest so much in your wife, you take her shopping to Paris, you bring her all the latest fashions, and of course she runs away with your best friend, because he's more wealthy than you. Or whatever else it is, you know what it's like. How can you really have any security in life? And I look at myself as a monk who's got no money. And I have no health insurance. I have no superannuation. No pension plans. And I'm getting old now. And I think, wow, what am I going to do next? But you know, I don't worry about my future. I've got greater investments than you have. Karma investments. Because of how much I've served, how much I've given over these last years, I know I don't have to worry about anything for my future. Even when I go overseas, sometimes I ask if you've got any health insurance, because things happen when you're overseas. You may get into an accident or fall sick or something. But I say that I have health insurance when I go overseas. There's enough people who care about me when I go to Singapore or Thailand or Sri Lanka. And I know I'll get the best of care if I feel sick, if I fall sick. The same here. Why? It's because I've been kind enough to many people that people just want to be kind back. That is my health insurance. I paid with many, many installments of kindness and giving to others. And this is what I know will come back to me. It's basic Buddhist teachings. If you want security for your future, make lots of good karma. Be kind, be generous, be there for others, and others will be there for you. Which is why that wealthy people sometimes get so lonely. They wonder why I've got all this money but I can't get the best care. Sure, they've invested in the share market, but they've never invested in the karma market. This is the Wall Street of Australia, down the local Buddhist centre. This is where you can make great investments with guaranteed returns, and the Buddhist karma stock market never crashes. It always is there for you, for this life and the next. And that actually, this is not just a joke, this is not an exaggeration, that people actually craving and desiring, they want happiness, they want peace. And what, ask yourself sometimes, what do I really want in life? Sometimes people say they just want to be cared for. And how do you become cared for? You don't become cared for because you're rich. You just become exploited, or you become sort of feared. You become cared for when you know how to care for others. This is again what karma is all about. So if your desire is to care for other people in this world, if that is your craving in life, seeing how much I can care for others, then you're putting the craving in the right place. The craving to have a more harmonious, peaceful, sharing, kind, warm society. Not having big houses, again, by having big hearts. Big-hearted communities which really look after one another. That's sometimes why that in the poorer suburbs, people look after each other much easier. Now my mother, because I came from a poor family, has always lived in what was called council flats. Council flats were state-subsidized housing. And even after my father died, we just moved from one council flat to another. My poor mother lived in this council flat for many years. And these big tall tower blocks in London were supposed to be a hotbed of crime. So my little old mother was a prime suspect, according to the sociologists. But she lived in this tower block for many years, and I remember when I went to visit her and stayed in that tower block for a short while. I was going to give a talk in the Sri Lankan Wihara in Chiswick one day, and it was not that far from where my mother lived, so I wanted to walk. And I enjoyed those walks through the streets of London, especially in my robes, because I was always a radical. I wanted to surprise and stagger and confront people with my sartorial elegance of brown robes. But I also enjoyed having fun, because people would look at me and sometimes, not knowing exactly what you were, dressed in these robes, these like what people used to call like bed blankets, that sometimes they would cross to the other side of the road. But I'd always take pleasure in wishing them good morning with a smile. And to an Englishman, if someone actually wishes you good morning, you have to say good morning back. It's psychological torture for them. But being a sadist, I enjoyed that. But anyhow, on this particular occasion, when I got to the in the elevator, the lift, and got to the bottom, as the doors opened, I was the only one in this elevator, as the doors opened, I was confronted by an old lady who was covered with blood. It was like a scene out of a movie. I didn't know what had happened to her, whether she'd been attacked, mugged, or whatever. But she actually told me she'd fallen down a flight of stairs. And she must have been about 65 or 70. But she could still stand, and so immediately I forgot about giving a talk at any sort of vihara. It's more important, I'm kind and compassionate, I practice Buddhism rather than teach it. So I forgot about the talk, and actually took this old lady upstairs to my mother's apartment, where we bathed her wounds, called the ambulance. She did have a broken leg, but because of the shock she couldn't feel the pain at the time. So we bathed her, comforted her, called the ambulance. But the wonderful thing which happened was that, you know, because it was an accident and because I sort of took her into my mother's apartment very quickly, my mother left the door open. And there was a trail of blood which was leading into my mother's apartment. And I was so pleased that in a matter of 5 minutes, I don't know how many people had come into my mother's apartment to find out what was going on and whether she was all right. And when they found out the reason why, that one of the tenants in this apartment block had had an accident and fallen over and was wounded, it was wonderful to see a community coming together and helping one another. I was bathing the wounds because my mother doesn't like blood. And someone else was going to her house to actually to turn her oven off because she had something in the oven cooking, and somebody was going to ring her daughter somewhere else. And everybody was working together so well, I thought, this is not a hotbed of crime. This is a community where people care about each other. And it's because they were all poor. They weren't afraid of one another. And I thought that actually one of the reasons why community was made in this tower block was because of the elevator. Every day people will be stuck together in this very small elevator, not these big elevators they find in these, you know, big mansions, but small elevators. Small elevators are great. you're stuck together going up and down, no matter how much of a stiff upper lip, how reserved you are as an English person. When you see the same people up and down the lift after a couple of years, actually you start talking to them. When you start talking to them, you get to know them. When you get to know them, you become friendly. When you become friendly, you start caring for each other. That's one of the lovely things which happen when you live in small places. People get to know each other and care for one another. And I thought, wow, that place is not wealthy as far as material things are concerned. But what a wonderful thing it is to know that somebody will switch off your oven, you know, if you have to go to hospital unexpectedly. That someone will bathe your wounds. That someone will look after you and care for you. And that's called health insurance. The real one. Because there's always someone to care because you have cared for others. And that's perhaps what people want most of all. To be cared for, looked after, especially in times of difficulty and stress. So really, when we talk about craving, this is really what we should be craving for. We should be using our mental energies, using our desires to build up something which is really worthwhile in life. Instead of these false chimeras like big houses, big bank balances, big cars, and fancy clothes. See, you don't need fancy clothes to get on in life. But this is why I tell people I wear brown robes. These are far more practical, these brown robes like this. Because whenever I spill a cup of tea, I don't need to wash it. The brown goes to brown. Most stains are brown stains, and that's one of the reasons why we have sort of brown robes, because they're easy to look after. And this actually, it seconds as a blanket at night time. So it's just so practical to have few things and use them well. I don't know how many clothes you have, or especially those poor people who are young who have to wear designer clothes, designer shoes, designer everything. It's great being like a monk. We're so simple. The same robe we wear day in or day out. I wear this robe to see the Queen of England. I wear this robe to see the builders at the builder site and the retreat centre. Isn't it wonderful? You don't know, I'm seeing the Queen today, what should I wear? I'm only seeing the builder, what should I put on today? It's the same before I saw the Queen, I never had a haircut either. Same old thing. Well, the President of Sri Lanka, all these other people you tend to go and see. So it's great being simple. So my craving is just to see how simple I can make my life materially. And how rich I can make my life emotionally, caring, and looking after others. And that's precisely what we learn in Buddhism. You see, you don't need that much to be happy. The secret of happiness, and I'm saying this because someone asked me today, can I talk about the secret? Because the secret is a book with a video. Which has sold a lot of copies and has made the author into a very unhappy rich person. Stupid. But that's not the secret of like winning something and it comes to you. Because sure, there's something to that. If you imagine it, if you with it long enough, eventually it will come. But do you really want that? Is that how you're going to use the power of your mind just to get the car parking space you want in the mouth? It's much better to have a car parking space further away. Then you get some exercise. And then you don't die of a heart attack when you're 40. So the thing is, yes, there's some truth to that, but it's wanting the wrong things. Wouldn't it be wonderful if that book said, if you could just imagine world peace? Or you can imagine just, you know, poor people in Africa having wells in every village. Or you can imagine just people in Perth having enough water because they don't sort of sprinkle their gardens too often. Or you can imagine people being kind to each other. You can imagine people, say, in the buses or in the trains, giving their seat up to elderly or sick or pregnant people. It would be wonderful if the different communities, whether it's the Aboriginal community or the other ethnic communities, can live together in peace and harmony. be wonderful if, you know, we can have love between our families and, you know, kids looking after one another and looking after their parents. It would be wonderful if there was no violence in our schools. But dreaming of things like that, I think, is far more worthwhile, you know, than sort of dreaming about material things. And so that sort of secret, that's not a secret to happiness, that's a secret to more headaches and more problems in the world. So the real secret, you know, was, you know, revealed by the Buddha, if you like, this common knowledge now, it's not secret, we teach it all the time, is if you really want something in life, if you're really aiming for something in life, if you are using craving and the power of your physical body and mind to do something, to get something, please get the right things in life. The things which are really worthy, and don't use the power of your mind for second-rate sham stuffs. Otherwise you're just like, you know, the person going to the dodgy brothers car dealers and getting an old bomb as a car. Because that's what that sort of book reminded me of. People selling false goods. So if you really want happiness, contentment, kindness, compassion, generosity, that's what makes the world go round. That's what inspires, brings happiness, brings peace, and brings a world in which you want to live, rather than a world in which we always complain, oh, why is it like this, and why is this all happening? So, use your craving for the right goals. And if you start to use your craving for the right goals, for things like peace, for harmony, for kindness, for generosity, you will also find that that's precisely how one gets success in meditation. Why people love to meditate, and why people like to become monks and nuns sometimes. People often say the happiest time of their lives is when they're at peace. And actually that's what we say, isn't it? Peace is golden, or silence is golden, and peace of mind is the most valuable commodity in the world. Isn't that really why we search high and low for a partner, you know, for a lifestyle, so we can have a few moments of peace? So really the craving, if you really want to crave the right things, we really want to crave for peace. Peace in our own hearts. If you can't find peace in your own hearts, of course you can never make peace in the world. All the peacemakers have a lot of anger inside of them. They have also a lot of self-doubt. And because of that, they can never make real peace. Only a temporary pause and ceasefire in the hostilities between mankind, womankind, or the planet. But when we learn how to find a bit of peace in our own hearts, then we understand what is truly worth craving for. Which is why in that book which I wrote, Open the Door of Your Heart, I said one way of making that peace in your own heart. Will you say to yourself, whoever I am, whatever I've done, the door of my heart is open completely to me. You make peace with your past, not by fighting it, but by accepting it. You can't make peace and war at the same time. Peace means accepting, embracing, being one with something. It's another word for unconditional love, acceptance, embracing. So when you embrace the moment, you embrace yourself, you embrace the people you have to live with, only then can you find peace. And this is precisely what one does in meditation. That meditation is almost like a training ground, like a gym, where one learns the strengths of character so that one can go and take those skills out into the world and really make something of this world, instead of making problems. So learning how to make peace in one's meditation of sitting here for half an hour, you know, a short time ago, did you make peace or did you make war? Did you try and fight all the defilements, the wandering mind, the itchy head, the aches and pains? Did you try and fight the past and future? Or did you learn how to embrace and make peace with it? When you realize what craving does, it makes war. When you understand that peace, kindness, gentleness gives you the highest happiness, but only do you understand how to make peace with yourself and be truly free and be rich. Because the highest wealth, even in our English language, is called to want for nothing. To want for nothing. How much do you need before you can want for nothing? You need nothing at all. You have enough right now. A moment of contentment, a moment of accepting yourself, the situation, your partner, your life, in this moment is a moment of great peace. Once you understand that peace in the heart, you understand what enlightenment is, what the aspiration of Buddhism is. Why we meditate, why we keep precepts, why we come here to listen to talks like this, because every now and again you get a taste of freedom, a taste of peace. A beautiful silence in the heart where you want for nothing. When you want for nothing, it's the most beautiful feeling in the world. Completely content, at ease, and happy with this moment. And as a result of that, you know what compassion is. And no one, not even monks, sit in meditation forever. Half an hour, 2 or 3 hours on retreat. And of course, then you come and take that peace and put it there in the world. So your craving is sometimes to make peace in your heart. And with your eyes are open, you're out of meditation, to create the same peace in this world. Using the same way. To embrace the people you're with. To be kind to them, to be gentle, to be soft. We call that making good karma. The generosity, the kindness, the compassion. That's really what we should be craving for. And if we can make that in this world, sure, we work hard, we have our job, we contribute to society, but then we never have any stress. Our work does become our vocation becomes our vacation, as Mark Twain used to say. We enjoy what we're doing, because we're not doing this for money. We're not doing this for the salary for the big house. We're doing this for peace. We're doing this for kindness. We're doing this to contribute to the happiness of our world. When the goal becomes well aimed, we never get the collateral damage of environmental destruction, of broken families, of corruption and war. It's not that craving is wrong, it's we're craving for the wrong things. The things which lead to suffering, rather than the things which lead to peace. So there's a challenge for you in this life. You have desire, you have craving, you have aspirations. What is really worthwhile aspiring for? Where do you want to be in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years' time? Where do you want the world to be? Really, it's up to you to crave for the right things. Thank you for listening. So, somebody's celebrating my talk tonight with a firework display. I'm very proud of that. So, has anyone got any comments or questions about the talk tonight, about the secrets? Craving. Are there any comments or questions for the second time? For the third time? Gone. So thank you for coming. We now have a few announcements, if you'd like to listen to them. They may be things which might change your life for the better.